Welcome to the Divorce Survival Guide podcast, where we have open and honest conversations about co-parenting, separation, divorce, and the hardest question of all, should you stay or should you go? I'm Kate Anthony, your Divorce Survival Guide, and I'm here to help you navigate some of the roughest waters you've ever swum in and answer some of your toughest questions. I've been to hell and back. And now it's my mission in life to help you get to the other side of this process with your sanity and your heart intact.
Hey everyone, welcome back. Happy July. Can you believe it? Holy moly. Summer, she is flying by. So today I have with me, I brought back my friend Lena Derhali. As I said, I think I told you in our first episode that Lena wrote two books. And, you know, she first came to me to talk about the Facebook narcissist. And then I found out that she wrote a book on Chris Watts. And I was like, oh, yes, we will be doing a show on that as well. So that's what we are here to talk about today. I just want to remind you that if you haven't submitted a Q&A and you have something that you want me to answer on a Q&A episode, submit them kateanthony.com/questions and I will get to them. And I am spending the rest of this summer writing my book. So it's due to the publisher in September. It will not be out until 2024, so don't get too excited. Just send me all the positive, happy vibes because I think I'm gonna need it. That's all. All right. So, just a recap, Lena Derhali is a licensed and Imago certified psychotherapist in private practice. She is the author of the Amazon true crime and criminology bestseller, My Daddy is a Hero, How Chris Watts Went from Family Man to Family Killer, and the forthcoming pop psychology book, The Facebook Narcissist, How to Identify and Protect Yourself and Your Loved Ones from Social Media Narcissism. She was also formerly a clinical instructor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the George Washington School of Medicine, where she mentored medical students. So Lena knows what she's talking about. So we're going to talk about Chris Watts. If you don't know who Chris Watts is, we're going to break it down in the beginning of this episode. So listen up. Here's my conversation with Lena. Lena, thank you so much for coming back and talking to us about your first book. Spoiler, when I first met Lena, we were going to talk about the Facebook narcissist, which we've already done. And then I found out that she wrote this book about Chris Watts, and I immediately was like, oh, we need to talk about that too. So here we are.
Yeah. Thank you for having me back to talk about Chris Watts.
Yeah. So for those who don't know this story, will you kind of give us the sort of overview of who Chris Watts is and what he did?
Yes, for sure. So in 2018, August 2018, to be exact, the world was sort of captivated by this media story that really took off because there's this man named Chris Watts and his pregnant wife, Shanann, and his two daughters, Bella and Cece, who were 3 and 4 years at the time, 3 and 4 years old at the time, had vanished into thin air. Like, you know, just within maybe 5 hours from their last contact, they were just gone. And everything was still there. The car seats and the car were still in the garage, and they live in Colorado. So it's not a city where you just walk places. Shanann's purse and medications and keys and everything were still there. And so, you know, the media picked up on the story, missing pregnant women, little girls. And Chris Watts did this interview on his porch pleading for them to come home. But every single person who watched that interview, including myself, was like, something is really off with
this guy. Something's off. Yes. Including me.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, he killed them.
Yes. Yeah. I think every single person who saw that interview, I don't know what it was, but there was something about him, and it didn't really match up though with the picture. So he's standing in front of this, you know, nice, beautiful suburban home, and he's objectively, you know, not knowing what he did, you would look at him and be like, oh, he's a pretty handsome guy, you know, tan,
oh yeah,
toned, you know, pretty nice looking guy. It seems like a normal husband and father. Anyway, it just unfolded really quickly, and within days, the FBI, the CBI, Colorado Bureau of Investigation, had got him to confess and to locate the bodies. And the bodies were of the girls were both in separate oil tanks on the oil field where he worked. And then his wife, Shanann, had been buried in a shallow grave not far from that. But in the beginning, and I think this is actually very important to the story and probably how, Kate, you and I are going to discuss the story, is in the beginning, in order to extract a confession from him, the CBI fed him a line, which was basically like, did your wife hurt the girls? And then did you hurt your wife? Because in these kind of, you know, investigations and interrogations, they want them to confess to something. They don't care what. So like, we just want to get you for something first. So Chris took that idea and was like, oh yeah, Shanann, I told Shanann I was leaving her. And then I saw her on the baby monitor strangling the girls. And so I went, and then I killed her in a fit of rage. And then I didn't know what to do. So then I went and buried them all. So that was, that's going to be a very important piece to how the rest of the story ends up unfolding. But ultimately he was convicted. He has life sentence. He was convicted on, you know, several counts of first degree murder, unlawful termination of a pregnancy, you know, tampering of evidence, all these different types of things. So, and ultimately he did fully confess multiple times to the real story, which was he murdered his children and his wife to start a new life with another woman.
And the new woman was like, well, what? Because the new woman didn't even know that he was married, right? Am I right?
Well, there's various accounts of this. There's a whole group of people who are dedicated to hating this woman. And she has, from what we know, changed her name and moved because of the harassment.
Oh my God.
I think, you know, she claims that she didn't know he was married, or he said that he was separating, which is totally possible.
Right.
However, there were some, they pulled up some of her internet searches and things. And a year prior to the disappearance, even this was even way before she even started her relationship with Chris, she had Googled the name Shanann Watts. And so like she had sort of been looking her up before. And Shanann had a very public Facebook profile, which again is very important to this case, because that's a lot of how we see the victim blaming unfold, was sort of this window into Shanann's life and her parenting and all of these things. So, I mean, people are a little bit suspicious, like you weren't Googling his ex and she's public, and like in her profile, she's posting about her third pregnancy and, you know, all these things. So it's hard to say if the other woman knew. But I strongly believe she didn't know he was going to kill his family. Like that's something I don't think she had any, you know.
She was not complicit in the murders.
No. Some people do think that, but I personally do not.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So why is this story important to us? Like, why are we talking about this story on this podcast?
Yeah, I think it's really important because the reason I wanted to write about the story, and it's the book is not just this true crime book, it's actually a case study in narcissism. And I was taken aback because when I was first watching the case unfold and getting into it before I even decided to write a book about it, I just could not get past the fact that Chris didn't seem like this sort of typical narcissist, in the sense that, you know, we talk about the love bombing, the devalue, and the discard phase, which he did all three of those. But the timeline of it was just really bizarre. And the fact that he was married and together with Shanann for 8 years in total, and his mask did not slip off until 8 years later when he started an affair with this other woman, which all it took was his wife going from Colorado to North Carolina for 5-6 weeks over the summer. Well, he stayed home because he had to work. And that's how this affair unfolded. And within that short time frame, he realized, I don't want to be married. I don't want to have a family. And I'm going to kill my family. But that like progression was so fast to me. I was like, how do you?
And we know this because they had such a, because Shanann had such a public profile because she was involved in some MLMs. And so she was, you know, she was always doing these Facebook videos, and he was often in them, and he was completely, as you know, there's so much evidence that shows this man is a completely dedicated family man.
Yeah. And even behind the scenes, you know, because he pled guilty so early on, the documents and all the investigation, it was all public and dumped out. And so I had hundreds and hundreds of pages of transcripts, but not only of that, of Shanann's private text messages with her friends. And so within, you know, and she was very honest with her friends. And so even though she wasn't airing out her dirty laundry on social media, behind the scenes, when she's starting to notice, when the devaluing phase starts happening, she's starting to notice that, you can tell the rug has been so pulled out from under her, because Chris was the one who wanted the third baby and kind of talked her into it. She was having the boy he always wanted and all of these things. So she's just, you know, like all of us who have been through the love bombing and then devaluing phase, it's just like such a shock when the mask comes off and the cruelty starts. And it's like, he obviously doesn't want anything to do with her anymore. And she's just shocked. Like, how does this person who I thought I knew for so many years is just like this, like you snap your finger and he is a different person. Like, and you can see her distress talking to her friends. Like, what is going on? Like, something's got to be up. This has never happened. We've never had problems like this, you know? So she was herself was like, what happened to my husband?
That I think is the fascinating part of this, right? It's that it really was on a dime. Like everything was great until suddenly it wasn't.
You guys, warmer, sunnier days are calling, and you're going to want to fuel up for them with Factor's no prep, no mess meals. Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are dietitian approved, and they're ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So no matter how busy you are, you're always going to have time to enjoy nutritious, great tasting meals. And I know that's really important to you guys right now. You're going through a hard time. You're in emotional upheaval, maybe some chaos. Really good, healthy, nutritious meals in 2 minutes. And I'm telling you, they're so good. You've got 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons to choose from every week. And you'll always have new flavors to explore. Treat yourself to restaurant quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, blackened salmon. Ugh, so good, you guys. So head to factormeals.com/DSG50 and use code DSG50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month. So the code is DSG50 at factormeals.com/DSG50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active.
No one told us the truth about parenthood. Why? This is the podcast everyone needed before they had kids, because now that those little ones are here, whew, there is a lot to unpack. I'm Rachel Shepardota, and I am your host for the podcast No One Told Us, where we tell the truth about parenting and let you in on all the stuff you really should have known about before having kids. I am the founder of Hey Sleepy Baby, but this podcast is so much more than sleep. We'll be diving into all the topics that you really care about and need to know while you do your best job raising those adorable, tidy humans. Our goal is to just make you feel less alone and less overwhelmed. There are so many things that no one tells us before becoming a parent, and I think that we should really pull back the curtain on becoming a first-time or second-time mom or dad to share the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll have a little education, a little fun, and a whole lot of heart that goes into each and every episode. So join me and our amazing guests each week to hear us talk about what no one told us.
And then it goes from like, it's great to like, oh, wow, he's kind of being an asshole, to murder.
Right. Within weeks. It's like she didn't even have time to process the change, because like the murder happened
literally the night she got home.
Weeks of him changing. Yeah.
And also like, she got home from North Carolina.
She was home for a week, and then she went on a short business trip with her company Thrive with some of her girlfriends. And even on the trip, you know, her friends were kind of like, she wasn't acting right. But he was playing along at this point because I believe, he had thought he had premeditated this. And so he was pretending like he was kind of into salvaging the marriage. So they were supposed to go to Aspen for the weekend together when she got back. So he's playing along with her, and her final text messages with him, she's asking him, what do you want for dinner? He's like, green beans. They're having these sort of mundane couple conversations with her having zero clue. In one of his confessions, he says that he smothered the girls in their beds before she got home. So you could potentially look at it as she's coming home to what she thinks is, a normal family environment when he may have already attempted to kill her children, because he also said that after his first attempt of smothering them, they were still alive, which kind of goes back to the torture he put his daughters through, because he essentially killed them twice, as he would say.
Jesus. So this is, like, as you said in your book, you sort of look at this as we're not changing into a true crime podcast here, you guys, even though that, you all know that that's, one of my obsessions, but we are not turning into a true crime podcast. We're looking at, like, what happened so that we can all sort of look out for the, like, were there signs that Shanann missed? Are there signs that we should be looking for? Like, how do we use this case as a study to help us understand this, this horrible, horrible,
yeah,
mental turnaround, yeah, right? Or,
yeah,
or reveal or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I believe there definitely were signs, but I have to say that before I say what I think there are, and that's why I wanted to write this book, is like, well, I don't think Shanann or anyone who knew him could have ever seen this coming or stopped it. I think that's impossible. Yeah. But I think there were some signs. But that said, some of these signs could also mean that this person is not a murderer or a psychopath. I also believe Chris Watts was a psychopath. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think he has any empathy or attachment. And, and I spoke to a criminal psychologist about this, and she calls him a failed psychopath, which I thought was really interesting, because psychopathy, we only see it as, if we're true crime junkies, as serial killers or people who torture small animals.
Right.
But a lot of psychopaths function in society and are never violent. And so those are the nonviolent psychopaths, or what criminal psychologists refer to as community psychopaths, and they could be your next door neighbor. They could even be a teacher in your kid's school,
Mm-hmm,
but the
mm-hmm.
thing about psychopaths is that they don't have the same emotional landscape that a normal person has. They don't have the same attachments. And so they're kind of flat, but they learn to mimic as they get older. They know they're different and they learn to mimic, and they start being able to mimic cognitive empathy. So they can be quite hard to spot, but they just generally don't have empathy or attachments to others, and they can't really bond with others in a real way, but they can learn to put on this mask. And, it's really interesting for the book. I researched people who are self-professed psychopaths, and they talk about their experience, of not being neurotypical and, like, observing and mimicking and crafting a mask to fit in with the world.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so there were lots of signs that
this is a Dexter. This is a Dexter yeah. moment, right? This is exactly yes. what, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And so Chris, I think there were lots of signs, even from a young age, that he was not emotionally attached to people and very flat affect. But I think he learned very early on to mimic really well. In fact, when you look at his text messages with his wife, he's mimicking her. And so she was a very exuberant person. If you looked at how she, typed her social media and put out her text messages, there's always a lot of, because I think she was a very effusive, exuberant person, which was mm-hmm. the opposite of him. Mm-hmm. She'd put exclamation points after everything. When Chris is exchanging messages with her, he's doing the same thing. He's putting like 5 exclamation points after something. But if you talk to people who knew him in real life, they were like, he was a really hard dude to get to know. In fact, nobody really knew him. And that's what people would say. Like, he's a nice guy. He's a calm, even keel guy, but I never really got to know him. So nobody ever knew who he was, which I think was really interesting. That was one thing, is that this sort of flat affect, shallow emotion, and people feeling like they never knew him. In fact, Shanann would say sometimes she'd try to kind of irk him on purpose and get him riled up just to provoke some emotion out of him because she didn't see it very much in him. There's some evidence there that, but again, that's not evidence to be like, this man's a murderer or this man's a psychopath, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and because like, obviously not all people with attachment issues are psychopaths, right? Some of them just have, are just avoidant. Right. Like, so what's the difference between avoidant and psychopathic? I mean, I know it's a huge spectrum, but
I mean, I think,
like, how do we know? How do we know if someone's like, just like an emotional avoidant versus dangerous?
I don't know if you can totally tell, but I can say that I think psychopaths are born psychopaths in the sense that we have a lot of brain scans and studies that there's, you know, gray matter missing in certain areas of the brain that process emotions and empathy and things like that. There actually is in my book an interesting study on narcissism in the brain too, that may have some similar, you know, lacking in empathy. Whereas, you know, people with attachment issues, that's usually from some kind of developmental trauma. That's more like environment born. Whereas I believe a true psychopath is born and can be, environment can exacerbate a psychopath for sure. But I think, you know, there's a difference between somebody who's putting up defenses to not get close versus someone who just doesn't have those emotions.
Right. Right. Okay. So, because, and there's a difference between in these brain scans, right? The difference between being like missing gray matter and underdeveloped or atrophied gray matter. Is that like a,
Yeah, it's more or less like that, you know, but they definitely can see these differences in psychopathic brains and even people with NPD. It may not be, I don't think it's necessarily the same exact thing, but where emotional processing is in the brain is it's not normal in these psychopathic brains and NPD brains. And so I think, again, that's why when you look at personality disorders, and some people would say antisocial personality disorder, which is in cluster B with narcissistic personality disorder, they would say like antisocial personality disorder is psychopathy or sociopathy. Yeah. And so that's why they say, you know, personality disorders are very, very hard to treat and to change. I'm not saying that you can't, but it's very, very hard when you have somebody who is unable for example, you know, in their brain, they literally cannot empathize.
Right.
We cannot change that. At least.
And then we can ultimately give them the tools. We can give them sort of the cognitive behavioral tools. But then what we're doing is teaching them how to mimic, which makes them hide in plain sight. It's not giving
some narcissists who are, you know, public out there and like in treatment and things like that, they'll say what hard work it is.
Yeah.
To actually try to like learn how to empathize. And it is possible. But again, I think there's a huge spectrum of people who are self-aware to a degree and want to change or are invested in changing versus people who are like sadistic and cruel and malignant narcissists or psychopaths or sociopaths who could kill someone and sleep at night and not feel any guilt about that. Like those people just exist, unfortunately. And we can't, the thing with this that was so scary about Chris Watts, though, again, is that it was so unpredictable because, you know, usually we watch Dateline and 48 Hours and all these shows. And a lot of these men who kill their spouses, you know, they have shown signs of something, either being really controlling, having some sign of, you know, paranoia or mental illness before, you know, especially with these family annihilators, because Chris Watts is also thought of as what's called a family annihilator. Usually family annihilators, their main motivation is not to be with another woman. It could be. But a lot of the motivation is they may have a psychotic break. There may be financial shame. They're trying to protect what they think is protecting the family from the shame and the ruin. But you can sort of see them, or you can look at, be like, oh yeah, there were clues. With Chris, it was just like, again, this father, this seemingly engaged husband and father who just changed the second his wife left town. And so again, that's why I think this story captivated the entire world. I mean, I know someone who was in Africa at the time this happened, was like, it was on the news in Africa.
Oh, wow. Wow. So, I mean, that's why this literally has a cult following, right? This whole story. And this is why.
Yeah. I think part of it was the social media presence and people really being voyeurs in a way that we never have before to a case like this. It's just the amount of video footage. And even in the investigation, the first officer on the scene to the Watts house when Shanann's first reported missing, literally within maybe 10 hours of her best friend last seeing her. Mm-hmm. This is a very short window of time. Officer Coonrod is his name. He is wearing a body cam. And so the entire interactions with Chris, and you can see his body language and how he's acting, like his wife and daughters are missing and there is absolutely no fear whatsoever. His FBI interviews are all video recorded. So not only do we have audio, we have all this video. We can see his body language. And so I think people were able to look inside to their world and into the investigation in a way that we've never seen before, ever.
Absolutely. There's a, I think it's, is it the Netflix documentary that is just basically comprised of mostly all of this footage. And I think one of the interesting moments too, is when they go, they're next at his next door neighbor's house, right? And they're interviewing him. And like, I guess Chris leaves and the neighbor's like, says to the cop, and you can hear it on the body cam, something's not right. Something's not right.
Something's not right with this guy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was also why I was able to write a book and really make it like I had dialogue, like and factual dialogue, because it was all on tape, you know, so I could construct a narrative of like, this is what happened. And it's factual, you know, because I had all of these tapes to reconstruct the story and the timeline for people.
We're looking at this story because there is this narcissistic personality disorder, psychopathy hidden in plain sight. Going forward with this, like, how do we learn from this and protect ourselves in a way when there aren't any red flags? We didn't have, there was, you know, besides him, like suddenly becoming weird, or an asshole, like.
I think my takeaway from this is, when we see somebody go to a devalue phase like that quickly, and he was so willing to leave his pregnant wife and his two toddlers. And again, I do not fault Shanann for trying to save her marriage. And, you know, she was trying, she's sending him self-help books, trying to get him to go to counseling, trying to, you know, take him away for the weekend, apologizing to him, saying, I'll do whatever it takes to save this marriage. I will change. I will, you know, make amends with your family, because she had issues with his family. But I think it was the hugest red flag that we saw was that, again, within weeks, he was able to be like, I'm going to walk away from my family. That is a huge red flag and a character flaw. Like, what kind of person tells their wife they want a third kid, convinces her to have it, and then is like, actually, no, I'm walking away from all this and I'm not even going to try. I'm done. And so I actually spoke to a neuroscientist for the book named Doug Fields, and he wrote a book called Why We Snap, Understanding, you know, the Rage Circuit in Our Brain. And it was really fascinating because I also did studies on rage, because a lot of people were like, Chris Watts snapped. And I was like, well, no, he didn't, in, you know, how we think of snapping, which is like within a second, you don't think, you go and you know, this was all premeditated. There's tons of evidence. He said it was premeditated. I think at least weeks in advance, he started thinking about the plan at least. But all my studies on snapping show that a process of snapping can happen in days, weeks, or months, meaning it's like this buildup process of, and you can premeditate too within that snapping process. But what happens in the brain is this doctor, Dr. Fields, discovered that there's these 9 neural pathways in the brain that immediately kind of activate someone into a violent response. And one of those triggers, he has an acronym for it called life morts. So it's a LIFEMORTS, and each one stands for a different trigger. And the S trigger stands for stopped. So he says when human beings feel like they're being stopped from something, that's one way that they will, that will make them violent. So in Chris's case, I'm like, okay, he's feeling like his wife and children are stopping, literally stopping him from living the life that he wants. And so he's building up weeks and weeks of rage at them and blaming them. Again, that's not the right thing. That's not the right way to look at it. But this is, again, the brain of a very emotionally immature and emotionally stunted person who is very selfish and narcissistic and probably psychopathic and not self-aware. So for him, he's so selfish that it's like the solution to that, to get the life he wants, is to just kill them. Which, again, these are very, when I studied psychopaths, one of the research studies I read said that the difference between like a normal, again, a normal person who's not a psychopath and a psychopath mm-hmm. is that when a psychopath has a problem, they turn to antisocial solutions like murder.
Oh, interesting.
When a normal person like Shanann has a problem, they turn to what's called pro-social solutions. And pro-social solutions therapy. Are what Shanann was right. doing. Therapy, books, reaching out to friends. And so again, that was a real indicator to me that the difference, at least in the brains and the thought processes of Chris versus Shanann and Chris versus a normal person. There's also really telling things Chris has said as in interviews that I've dissected that I'm happy to share with you
too. Yes, please. I'm curious.
When it comes to raising kids, there's so much to consider. Things like, what do we feed them? When do we feed them? How do they sleep? What does it look like to raise kind kids? How does their nervous system work? How do I keep myself calm? What are my triggers? There's so much that comes into play. And we are distilling all of that information for you at Voices of Your Village podcast, where we bring experts in the field of early childhood and education and psychology and across the board so that you don't have to comb the internet for information. You get to show up and hang out and have shame-free, judgment-free conversations and insights into what it looks like to raise kind, empathetic, emotionally intelligent humans. I'm Alyssa Blask Campbell. I have a master's degree in early childhood education. I'm a mom of two, and I am walking this journey right alongside you doing this work. Come hang out with me at Voices of Your Village, and we can dive into real conversations with actionable tips.
Hey there, I'm Debbie Reber, the founder of Tilt Parenting and the author of the book Differently Wired. The mission of Tilt is to change the way neurodivergence, whether that's having a learning disability, having ADHD, being gifted, autistic, or some combination of all of the above, is perceived and experienced so differently wired kids and the parents like us raising them can truly thrive. On the Tilt Parenting podcast, I get to talk with authors, therapists, educators, and parenting experts who are committed to this mission. I ask the questions my listeners are most curious about when it comes to supporting our kids. And in turn, my guests share strategies for challenges, out-of-the-box ideas for navigating school, best practices for therapies, tips for advocating, and so many thoughtful insights on what it really takes to help our kids grow up feeling seen and respected so they can create awesome lives for themselves. I know that raising a differently wired kid can feel overwhelming and isolating, but I promise you, you are not alone, and it can feel so much better. If you're on this parenting journey, come listen to Tilt Parenting. Together, we can shift this paradigm and show up for our exceptional kids with hope, possibility, and joy.
Yeah, but I think I want to highlight that, like, for people listening, like, if we're like, what are we going to take from this, right? To possibly look for those antisocial solutions, like, okay, maybe not murder. When we are trying to present these pro-social, is that what you called it?
Yeah. Pro-social and antisocial solutions.
Yes. Problem. If we are coming at this with pro-social solutions and someone is denying them or coming up with other solutions that are not pro-social, right? I mean, if we're saying let's go to therapy and they're saying no, that doesn't make them a psychopath.
No, not at all. But I think what is something to pay attention to is, again, that ability to walk away.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's not just one thing if it's you, it's small children and a pregnant wife without, I mean, even if they're not murderers, something is wrong.
Yeah.
Something's not right. And you don't want to be with a person right. who's going to walk away from you like that when after all of that. And so my whole thing in the book was, if somebody is going to be so willing to easily walk away from you, mm-hmm. maybe take a step back and don't fight them. Kind of just okay. let them go.
Yeah.
This even if you have young children, you know, even if it doesn't mean they're going to murder you or they're going to be a psychopath, but I mean, at least it will give them the space to reflect. And it's sort of the idea, if somebody doesn't want to be with you, you don't want to force them there. No matter what, if psychopath or not, it's not going to end well, you know, trying to force somebody to be with you.
Right. That's right. That's right. I mean, I just have, like, I'm thinking about the clients that I have and the numbers of stories I've heard of women, because I work with women and that's the demographic that I hear from, who mm-hmm. say, you know, please let's go to therapy. And the husbands will say, literally, I would rather get divorced than go to therapy.
Oh yeah. I've had a client with husbands who have said the exact same thing.
Right. And so like, that doesn't make them a psychopath, right? We shouldn't conflate these things.
Not at all. No. Okay. And in fact, a lot of, again, these same people have developmental trauma or had bad prior experiences in therapy. Their defenses are so strong, but those could be narcissistic defense. Those are some traits of narcissism for sure, to be that defended.
Yeah.
To be like, I'm not going to cooperate or try compromising, to be in this relationship with you.
Right.
You know, but it does not mean they're a psychopath, and it doesn't mean they're a narcissist either, but they could have some of those traits, because narcissism is also in theory thought to be a defense mechanism to protect from a lot of childhood developmental trauma. Now, not with all of them, but
right. That's right. Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that you take that and you're like, okay, because a lot of the time you deserve more.
Well, right. And I was going to say, just because he's not a psychopath doesn't mean that like this is a healthy relationship for you to stay in.
Right. And as a therapist, I don't tell people what to do. You know, I'm not going to be like, you should or shouldn't leave this relationship. But I do say this, I don't really work with couples where one person has NPD or has shown signs of no empathy. And I've had couples like that come in where I didn't know. And I've basically said, because Imago, the therapy I do is all about empathy.
Right. Exactly.
And I remember one particular session I had where the husband was criticizing his wife in front of me for just like how she washed the dishes. I mean, it was just real, real cruelty, you know, like he's picking on her for the littlest things with such contempt and disdain. She's just sitting there crying the whole time. And I'm just, you know, I was relatively new as a couples therapist. But, you know, I turned to him at some point and I said, if we're going to continue with these sessions, you have to learn to try to empathize with your wife. And he turned to me and he looked at me and he said, I have no empathy for my wife. And I said, then I can't work with you, because it's only going to traumatize her even further to sit. You know, like, I'm not going to sit here and listen to you berate and belittle her in front of me, her in front of me. And I can't tell her, oh, you got to leave this guy. But I've spoken to women on the phone before and they've told me stories like this. And I'm saying, I can't condone that. I can't, there may be another therapist who will work with you, but I cannot do that, because I think you deserve more than that. And I can't sit there and be okay with that.
Yeah.
And I'm very honest about that.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. Because I mean, I think there's so many therapists who feel constrained, right? You know, and this is why I'm a coach, not a therapist, right? Because I, you know, I can say, be more directive, right? This is why I'm not a therapist or a mediator, because I can't hold back.
Yeah.
But there are, you know, I think they're lucky to have at least had 5 minutes on the phone with you to hear, like, no, that's not okay. And you deserve more than that.
Yeah. Well, I've actually, since writing this book, I've heard from so many women all over the world who have been in relationships with narcissists and psychopaths. And one of the things they always say is, my therapist didn't believe me either, because I'd be in couples therapists and I was the crazy one. And so a lot of my friends and I have actually been talking about this in regards to the Amber Heard and Johnny Depp trial. Because, you know, we're saying like, okay, maybe there's dysfunction with both of them, but the way Amber Heard is portrayed as the crazy one, when so many women who have been in abusive relationships are like, I was so dysregulated by the abuse that it, you know, and so women have come to me and said, like, my therapist thought my husband or boyfriend was like the greatest thing in the world. Meanwhile, you know, he's got all these prostitutes behind my back and, you know, horrible, horrible things. And so as a therapist, I'm super sensitive to, not allowing myself to be, you know, sucked into that and, the damage and the re-traumatizing it causes women who are in these abusive relationships to have to sit in therapy and have the therapist kind of fawn all over the narcissist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's really bad. And so but there's not enough therapists who are trained in this to really understand that. And a lot of couples therapists, unfortunately, are trained where I know many of them who like think that we can empathize. It just takes time and you can get them to empathize or come around. And I always say abuse is a no for me.
Yeah.
Any type of abuse.
Well, I mean,
unless the person's like, I want to change and I want to stop being an abuser. And I'm like, okay, great. If the person wants to change, we can try. But for someone who is like, I have no empathy for my wife and I'm not going to try to empathize. Hell no.
Hell no. But would you do that in a couple setting, or would you do that? Like, would you still subject the wife to his abuse healing process? Like, is that?
I wouldn't allow abuse in my office. You know, I wouldn't allow any criticism. Part of Imago is we teach people how to reframe and restructure frustrations. And so, you know, I have some outdoor work going on right now.
I can hear that.
Yeah. Sorry.
Do you want to take a pause for a second? Do you want to pause?
I can talk. But anyway, you know, we tell people in all my sessions, you know, and most of my sessions do not have very, you know, lovely people, again, who may have learned things at home when they were kids and bad modeling. Mm-hmm. And don't know how to talk to each other. But in Imago, we teach people to talk to each other when they're frustrated with kindness.
Yes.
And so that's like, I don't allow any type of criticism or abusive language mm-hmm. in my sessions at all.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you couldn't really mirror or...
No.
Here you go. It doesn't really work in the Imago process.
We do not allow people to mirror criticism or anything like that. But again, I have not... Most of the time I refuse to work with those kind of people unless there is a huge amount of insight and dedication to changing.
Yeah.
And knowing that what they're doing is wrong.
Right.
So one of the things he said, which I thought was really, I mean, if you want to know what a psychopath is like, this, he was talking about to the investigators that if he made up this fake scenario, if he was in a grocery store and he lost his children. So I talk about this in a lot of interviews just because I think it's so interesting. You know, as a parent, Kate, and I've talked to other people, if you're a parent, even if you're a parent of a pet, okay, say your pet goes missing for a few hours, right?
Panic,
right? And now if your kid goes missing in a grocery store for a few minutes.
Oh,
in a playground? Even if you can't see them for a second, your heart it's just this instinct, right? Of panic.
Yeah. I lost my son once for like a good 20 minutes.
Oh, that's
like
horrifying.
A really crowded, massively crowded Easter thing in a park. Like, I mean, terror.
Yes. It's horrifying.
Terror.
And so Chris here is like, oh, you know how people, you know, panic when they lose their kids in a grocery store? And he's talking about how he knows he's different. He said, if I lost my kids in a grocery store, I wouldn't panic. I would just walk around calmly and look for them. And I was like, oh, okay. So this is Chris noticing his differences again from people.
Was this later in interviews later, or is this like text messages or conversations from before?
This is not with his wife. This was, I believe, actually, this particular interview might have been after he confessed,
after he
was sentenced, because the investigators were so haunted by this trial and this investigation, and he hadn't really spoken. They actually flew to his prison in Wisconsin months later and spoke with him for several hours. Maybe it may have even been 4 hours or something. And that is all on tape as well. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he's also, you know, he'll say in that same interview that he had to read a book to understand that fathers would never hurt their children. And so I was like, you had to read a book to understand that? Like,
wow. Know?
And when he speaks about his children, it's all about him. So, you know, he was crying. He's like, all I ever wanted was children to love me. The language all about me. It's never about, he doesn't speak about his children, about them ever. It's never about them and who they are. And in fact, it's always about what they do for him. So it's either his image as a father. And in the book, I say, I think he's closest to the profile of the communal narcissist who gets their narcissistic supply by being trustworthy and good. And so I think he built up this good guy persona. He also cared very, very much about what other people thought. So when Shanann's missing and her friends are frantic and texting Chris, he's like, oh, I don't want you to think I'm a bad person, he says to one of them when he was saying, hey, we're separating. And I'm like, your concern when your wife is missing is how people are going to view you. Again, very narcissistic. It's all about him all the time.
That's
and
right.
So it's, you know, you see all of this, and I'm seeing it now in hindsight, like almost every other sentence out of his mouth is narcissistic and selfish. And again, so emotionally spoiled and immature, like a toddler almost.
Right.
But I'm not sure if Shanann, you know, and again, this is me being like, oh, this is after he slaughtered his family. I can look at all these statements.
Right.
And say, but, you know, but I don't know if this was picked up on by anybody else ever. You know, I think his mother had said like she knew he was different from a young age, or he was, you know, kind of.
I remember there's like, there's something about his mom, and I don't remember like in court. And it was like whether it was him crying and apologizing to her or her statement or something. Like I remember something about his mom and just it being just heartbreaking.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, I don't think his family has ever fully accepted that he's even responsible for this. And so there's a lot of, you know, stuff out there about if he's never held responsible, if he's always the golden boy, then, you know what I mean? There also is that creation of narcissism in that way as well. And so, you know, in her speech in the court, she did say she forgives him.
Maybe that's what I was thinking about. Yeah.
Yeah. And she's crying, you know, saying she forgives him and all of these things. And, you know, I don't want to judge anybody who has had to go through something like that to their child, like being such a murdering their own children. I mean, So I can totally get why people would be in denial about that. And I can, you know, understand how that could happen, but, you know, it was interesting. Again, it's about, it's always been about him and finding excuses as to why he couldn't have done it, you know, or finding reasons to blame Shanann, which I always want to go back to, is the victim blaming has just, I've never seen anything like it, like I have in this case. And also people just wanting to blame the women. Like I said, if you're not blaming Shanann, there's people out there who are blaming the woman he had an affair with.
That's right.
You know, it's always a woman's fault, or some people out there are blaming the mother. You know, it's always the woman. And in fact, if you go to my book Amazon page, the most helpful, you know, you can mark a review as helpful. The most helpful review is a 1-star review of my book written by somebody who calls me judgmental for judging
Chris. For judging Chris Watts.
Yeah, is that funny? But also, if you look, it's a common theme in these negative reviews. They're angry with me for not telling the truth about Shanann, implying in these reviews that there was a responsibility by her in some way for her death.
Wow.
Some people have their real names attached to these reviews too, which is scary in itself. It's like, wow, you really think it's okay to blame a woman where her husband murdered her.
Yeah.
Pregnant in cold blood and her daughters and put them in oil tanks. But I am preserving. There's nothing this woman did wrong. First of all,
nothing. Literally
you didn't
nothing.
Like her social media posts that you knew her through social media. No, you didn't know her. Right. You weren't her friend. You don't know her. You can't judge someone based on their social
and
media posts.
By all accounts, she was a lovely, lovely woman.
This is the other thing I say in my book. This woman had so many friends. The reason the case unfolded the way it did was because her friends were so worried about her within hours.
Right.
They knew she was missing within hours.
Because
they were so connected. And she had so many people that cared about her. And so many people that loved her. Chris had no real friends, by the way. None.
Yeah. Yep.
So what does that tell you?
Also a red
flag. What
does
that tell you?
Mm-hmm. Well, and it also points, I mean, it's like, again, just because your husband has no friends doesn't mean he's a psychopath, because the way that we condition men in our society is such that so many men don't have friends.
Right.
But this is a problem.
Yeah. And I talk about this too in the book. Mm-hmm. There's a book called No More Mr. Nice Guy that I cite in my book, which is like, I do think part of the issue is that we're raising boys to feel like it's not okay to have emotions. And then they come out in these really unhealthy ways.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
And, you know, I have a quote from Mark Lamont Hill, who's a scholar, who's like, the only emotions that we are told are okay are like sexual desire and anger. Right. Those are the only socially acceptable emotions for boys and men. And I know the tide is turning a bit on this, and that it's getting better. And I, you know, as a mother of a son, and you as well as Kate, you know, I know that we're trying really hard to fight that in our own boys, but like the messages they're still getting outside of the home still very much are like, you know, these kind of toxic masculinity themes, that we really have to work hard to break down, because, and I do think that plays a part in all of this, is, you know, the inability for men to be able, and even psychopathic men or narcissistic men, to be able to talk about things maybe somebody could have said, hey, there's a different solution to you, you know, if you'd been in therapy, who knows, you know, but I do think that's a real part of the issue as well.
Yeah. I mean, he had no one to talk to say, God, I'm feeling constrained. I'm feeling like I want something else.
He's got all this rage bubbling inside and he's blaming his wife and daughters for his, you know, his life. He's a big boy, he's an adult man, but like he's letting it simmer and simmer inside until he explodes, which again is sort of the snapping part, you could say, which could be premeditated, but it's like the simmering is going on until, you know, it's like I said, it's a perfect storm of factors, really.
Yeah, it really is. So I want to go back before we end here. Let's go back to victim blaming and women always being sort of held responsible for their own victimization, and Amber Heard. The vitriol, the rage against Amber Heard is astonishing to me. Yes, and I already hear I can hear it now, a bunch of listeners even, right? Mm-hmm. Listeners to this podcast, people who are feminists, people who believe women, still don't believe Amber Heard. So what the fuck is going on, Lena?
I mean, again, it's, you know, we are voyeurs into something we really know nothing about. We have some video, you know,
we're learning a lot.
We have video, we're learning a lot for sure. But again, I look at it as I don't really even fully know what's going on because I'm an observer. Mm-hmm. But I do know that they're, like I said, to put the full blame on Amber Heard to me is just, that's not right. It's not okay. You know, and the labels and the trolling, you know, we know now people are paying bots to have this, which is in the news recently. Bots are being paid by Johnny Depp's team, I think, to circulate.
To slander her.
Yeah.
Even though he's the one suing for slander.
But I think it was something from his team and these bots. Or, you know, there's a hashtag like Amber Heard is a psychopath and things like that. But also, I just don't understand why people care so much about other people's lives to the point where they want to tear somebody down like that. But yeah, it's really bad from a domestic violence standpoint and survivor standpoint. It's even just people watching it, it's just bad for the whole movement, what's happening.
It really is. And let's be really clear about why. Because, you know, women who are abused, who have not behaved well in the face of their abuse, because, as you said, they are, you know, neurologically kind of skewed at this point, right? I mean, they have, like, they are in a trauma response. They are not in their right mind. They are not in their right thinking. And all of their rational begging, pleading conversations, right? They go nowhere. So they take to, you know, we're caged animals, essentially.
Yeah.
And, you know, we exhibit really bad behavior, right?
Right. The whole dysregulation, you're dysregulated. You're trying to, you know, figure everything out. And yeah, you have these trauma responses that people are judging.
Right. And then when as a victim, you're watching this whole thing unfold and you realize that you are, quote, not the perfect victim, because Amber Heard is not the perfect victim, which doesn't exist.
Right.
The number of women or the number of victims, I should say, who are not going to come forward now because.
Right.
Because this is what happens.
Yeah.
This is the punishment.
And so many women already don't come forward.
Exactly.
It's like the amount of underreported abuse on any level is just, I don't even think we even know how vastly underreported it is because, especially if it's someone who's in power.
Right. And that's
like
the thing.
Someone was saying to me the other day, remind them a bit of Monica Lewinsky, Anita Hill type stuff before social media, you know?
Right. Exactly. And I think it's really important to, you know, one of the things that defines domestic violence and intimate partner violence is the imbalance of power.
Right.
And there, while there may be abuse, kind of what looks like on the outside, what they call mutual abuse, which I is not a thing. It may look like that from the outside to people who don't understand it, right? But when, mm-hmm. but people who are skilled in this and understand intimate partner violence understand that there is always a power dynamic and then power imbalance. And the primary aggressor is the person with the most power.
Yes.
And Johnny Depp had far more power, whether that was, you know, financial, you know, I mean, he was controlling what roles she took mm-hmm. and what movies she did.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say it because this is what everybody says. Yes, men can be victims. Absolutely.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah.
Men can be victims. In my opinion, from mm-hmm. watching and reading and also being a certified domestic violence advocate.
Yeah.
Johnny Depp is not a victim.
Yeah. No, I agree. I agree. I mean, but I think it needs to be spoken out, but even people are scared to speak up now because again,
you have
conservative hosts paying for $50,000 for ads to smear Amber Heard too. They like, what is that? You know?
Like, why this poor woman? Like, why are we so invested? Like, look,
that's what I'm saying.
It's like
to be invested to want to like be that cruel to somebody. What does that say about the person who's being cruel? Like, what is the need for that? What is the point of that? What is that accomplishing?
And why is that so systemic right now?
Yeah. And why do we care?
Right.
So much about, you know what I mean? I wish the trial wasn't televised.
Yeah. But why are we so invested in Johnny Depp? Right. Like I grew up, I am 51 years old. 21 yep. Jump Street was like, that was my teenage, that was it, you know,
right.
He, and you know, for those of you who are younger, there was a TV show before there was a movie. Johnny Depp walked on the scene, like, you know, like Brad Pitt. And it was like, whoa. And I, you know, spent many years obsessed with him. I can let that go.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Look, I can let that go. It's fascinating to me anyway. Okay. So takeaways about this Chris Watts, about what we should, like, what have we learned?
Yeah. Again, I think the whole devalue thing, like once a partner starts devaluing you,
mm-hmm.
I think it's a huge red flag to really pay attention to and, you know, really ask yourself, is this something that I want to continue and be with somebody who treats me like this or who could do this so quickly to me too? You know, I think that's a huge takeaway for me. Just thinking about, you know, our own worth. And now again, I have to say Shanann was pregnant, had two little girls and wanted to keep the family together. And of course I fully understand that and don't think she did anything wrong. But again, I think as women, we have a very low bar sometimes for what
we will
accept.
We do.
And sometimes, yeah.
And who's to say that Shanann would not have gotten there, but she didn't have time.
Oh, she would have. She didn't have time. I'm sure she would have. I think she was already thinking about it actually from some of her text messages. She was starting to think about what life with a divorce would look like and how she would do that as a single mother.
Right.
And she said, if he's cheating on me, it's over. I mean, she had, you know, she just didn't know.
Right.
And she didn't have time. And I think that's the huge tragedy of all of this is that, you know, she just thought, again, it was so fast. She just thought they were in a rough patch and, you know, maybe they could work it out. And she didn't have time to figure it out. And again, this is a very rare story, this type of story.
Yeah.
Which is why it's has so much media attention. So again, you know, but again, there is a high rate of partner men murdering their partners too. So, you know, we also can't be like, well, it's never going to happen to me. We also have to think it could happen to me.
That's right. It's important to not look at this and be like, oh, it's this one and done, like, you know, weird thing, because I think there is so much in it that is systemic that created this perfect storm.
Right.
But each of the components of the storm still exist very broadly in our society. And
very
we have to watch out for them.
Yeah. So I think, it could happen to you. Not saying it will, but it's, you know, we have to have our guard up and we have to protect ourselves and our children first and foremost. And I think that's the other thing in this story too, right? Is like protecting ourselves comes first.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Thank you so much, Lena. This is such a hard one, but I so appreciate all of your work and study on it and your book, which is available on Amazon and on your website as well. That's, is that lenadurvalley.com?
Yeah. Anywhere books are sold. Yeah, I can get it. But yes, and thank you, Kate, for having this platform to talk about this. I talk about victim blaming in the Facebook Narcissist too. So I'm very passionate about these topics and glad we were able to have this discussion, because I think it's really important that we have these places where people can just hear this kind of discussion.
Yeah. And we don't mean to panic people, but also we need to educate people.
Yes. 100% education. Yeah.
Thank you, my love. So good to talk to you as always.
You too. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Divorce Survival Guide podcast. If you like what you hear, head on over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen in and leave me a review. And don't forget to follow me on Instagram at The Divorce Survival Guide. I'll see you next time. And until then, remember, you, my love, deserve to be happy.
Feel like you're the martyr in your family? You're not alone. Hey, this is Joanne.
And Brie.
And we're from the No Guilt Mom podcast. Brie, we talk to a lot of moms.
Yeah, we sure do.
And if you're a mom who has a to-do list that is so massive that you get overwhelmed and you shut down.
Or if you fall into the habit of doing everything for everyone and don't know how to change it, we can help you become a no-guilt mom.
We're going to take you from family martyr to family model. That's role model, so that you role model the behavior that you want to see out of your kids.
You're going to go from being tired and overwhelmed to energized and guilt-free.
Every week, you'll get actionable strategies that you can implement right away from the experts that we interview and from us.
We also have a whole lot of fun, so check out the No Guilt Mom podcast everywhere you listen to your favorite shows.